Studio computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T-minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T-minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for QNN20K.
T-minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T-minus 15 seconds. T-minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. That right up right there, Mike.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Control room, you're on the air.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. In this segment, we're speaking to researcher Mr. Paul Abbott. Thank you, Paul, for taking time to talk to me today.
Oh, Leno, always good to be with you. Thank
good.
You.
You have an article, Fair Play for Bert Griffin and Leon Hubert of the Warren Commission. And this is up at Kennedy's and King. Like all good stuff that Jim DiEugenio has up there, a lot of times people don't know about the article. They missed it. So when they hear it on Black Op Radio, they get to hear the author just talking about it. And then they'll go back and read it. And so it kind of doubles the efficacy, I guess. I'm not sure if that's the right word for it. But, yeah. You know, we try to reinforce. There's such bad research going on and people still saying that it's a lone gunman, Leo. They trotted out Posner the other day. They wanted a comment on were they going to release some files. Trump may release them. It's coming up for this week. You know, knock on wood. We hope that happens. But they pulled Posner out to talk about it. And he goes, well, you know, this is old history and, you know, nothing's going to be in those files that doesn't disprove that Lee Oswald killed him. You know, it's like, I can't believe it. And even for them to record him and then to air that, you know, no wonder the legacy media, the mainstream media has failed to the point that people will tune into an internet show. You know, like Black Op Radio or some other, any Russell Brand, Joe Rogan, any of them. I listen to Jimmy Dore, by the way. But anyway, people, they enjoy hearing something that at least they know this is the truth. Now, do I agree with it or not? That's a different story. But I like to have, well, I like your work and anything that, you know, is at Kennedy's and King is going to be of a certain level, stature. So, first of all, thanks for writing. Thanks for your work.
Thanks to Jim for putting the article up. When you do something like that, you know, there's obviously an you're taking a bit of a chance, you know, putting it out there for someone else's consideration, and obviously the platform that Jim has with Kennedy's and King, and obviously through yourself, his regular appearances with you. It's the best platform to really get out some. You know, I wouldn't say alternative narratives, but things that are a little bit more in depth. And you know, you talk about Posner being rolled out by the, you know, the large creaky wheel of the legacy, you know, media. You know, we need to still keep digging. We still need to make sure that every cave in the mountain is being explored, so to speak. So it's always good to have work with Kennedy's and King.
Very good. So, like I mentioned, Bert Griffin, Leon Hubert, Warren Commission. First of all, before you get into the article, what caught your interest about these guys? Like, was there anything reading about them that was a catalyst that made you say, oh, I'm going to have to look into this further?
It was the in the article I directly reproduce a memo that Hubert and Griffin put forth to J. Lee Rankin, who was the senior counsel, their boss, basically, for the Warren Commission. And just for a bit more context, Hubert and Griffin were basically leading the Ruby, Jack Ruby, investigation on behalf of the Warren Commission. So they they mobilized down in Dallas, in very late March. In fact, it might have even been Ruby's first trial, in which he was sentenced to execution for killing Oswald. I think that's when Hubert and Griffin first rolled into Dallas and started taking depositions for their part of the Warren investigation. And so what ultimately culminated was in May, an 11-page memo, which I found when I was putting together my book, Death to Justice, on the shooting of Lee Harvey Oswald. And I just found that even as early as May, I saw it as evidence that there was evidence this early stage, because obviously the Warren report didn't come out until much later in 64, August, September, I think it was September. So we've got evidence of these two lawyers that are doing a fair bit of digging in terms of taking depositions of Dallas police officials, people that were associated with Oswald and Jack Ruby, and they came to some pretty interesting conclusions. So this memo that they put together was basically centered around three key questions. Why did Jack Ruby kill Lee Harvey Oswald? Did Ruby have any confederates in killing Oswald? And was Ruby connected to Oswald? And you can see in the memo that even while they're in Dallas, that's how they came to ask these three key questions.
Right. Okay, so it was that memo then. Right.
So
For people who don't know, then, as you mentioned, but we'll just get this on the record, they were two attorneys and they were looking into the Warren Commission, were tasked with looking into Jack Ruby. And that was their angle on it. And they were in Dallas, and you write here in late March, May of 1964, to question to people to really get behind it. So I'll take it away from there then.
So the memo in itself is very interesting, because my article was basically taking a bit of a looking at that article with a bit of perspective. Obviously, we have the benefit of 60 years now of knowing how the HSCA in 1978 would eventuate, and we know what happened with the ARB in the mid to late 90s, and obviously now we're faced with the potential for the JFK files to finally be released. But time is a very good way of giving us perspective. So what we know now is that Bert Griffin in particular came to be a very controversial figure in Dallas while he was down there, to the point where he was actually recalled back to Washington a little bit earlier than originally scheduled for when he and his colleague Leon Hubert were meant to go back. And the reason for this was that Griffin really, really latched on while he was collating all the information that would end up in that memo that I was talking about, that 11-page report. Griffin really, really honed in on a particular member of the Dallas Police Department, Sergeant Patrick Dean. I know you've had other people, John Armstrong in particular, speak about Dean in conversations, but it really is noteworthy because how Griffin was treated and the cover of protection that was put around Patrick Dean after his interaction when giving a deposition for Griffin for the Warren Commission is very telling. So really, it all started on the 24th of March, 1964, when Griffin sat down with Patrick Dean, and he basically had two key issues with what Dean was testifying to. So just pulling back on Patrick Dean a little bit, he was a sergeant with the Dallas Police. He wasn't on duty at the time of President Kennedy's assassination, but he was on duty on Sunday, November the 24th, when Oswald was himself shot. And Dean, as it happens, was in charge of the security for the Dallas City Hall basement, because that's where Oswald's transfer from City Hall to the county jail was to disembark from. So it was basically up to Dean and, to a degree, another sergeant, Putnam, to get the security all lined up for the basement to make sure all was ready for Oswald's transfer. So cut to after the shooting, and even after Dean testified at Jack Ruby's trial in March of 1964, Bert Griffin had him to take him for a deposition, and he wasn't buying what Dean was saying. He could himself sense that things weren't lining up. So in his deposition, Dean said that Griffin took issue with was that Ruby conceded that he'd been waiting to kill Oswald since Friday, November the 22nd. Dean said that Ruby conceded this straight away up on the fifth floor after the shooting of Oswald. And the other point that Griffin didn't believe Dean on was that Ruby admitted to straight away up on the fifth floor again to saying how he got into the basement. So two points there that Dean really didn't buy, and to the point where he actually went off the record, at a juncture, they took a break, and he actually took Dean aside and said, "Look, I believe you're an honest man. I respect you as a police officer, but what you're saying doesn't add up." So he was basically, kind of taking him aside and saying, "Look, do you want to try again, or is there anything more that you want to say? Because, you can be afforded a certain degree of protection. We can bring your attorney into this, and you can be advised accordingly." But Dean said, "No, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm telling you the truth, and I don't know why you don't believe me." So Dean was basically the star witness for the Dallas police in Jack Ruby's trial. He clearly felt very confronted by Griffin, for being taken off the record, and as he put it, basically being called a liar by Griffin. So anyway, the deposition continued on another tangent, something to do with, funnily enough, Len, someone that had contacted the Dallas Police Department all the way from Vancouver in Canada, saying that they were in Dealey Plaza on the south side, saying that they had footage of the entire assassination from the south side of of Dealey Plaza there. And Dean was the one that happened to take this call and turned out to be a dead lead. There was no footage that ever eventuated. But this is the tangent that Dean's deposition went on after this little off the record chat that Griffin had with him. So it's an interesting deposition, the conversation. But also, Dean was basically tripped up. He tripped himself up when Griffin asked him about the door that led down from the annex building, which was the building next door and still is next door to City Hall, and was directly above the car park. Griffin said, "You do know that the basement the doorway from the annex building into the basement doesn't lock on the inside because it's an emergency exit." And Dean literally gave no response, and it says that in the transcript of his testimony. And then he made up some line about telling a maintenance man to make sure that it was locked. Well, it was an emergency exit, so it couldn't possibly be locked, because that would defy the purpose of it being an emergency exit for the annex building down into the basement. It could be locked on the basement side, so people from the basement couldn't just walk up to the annex building from the car park. But Dean tripped himself up there, and there was no maintenance person that testified to A, being asked to lock that door, and B, that it was indeed locked on that day. So Dean really made himself, a real, put a spotlight on himself in his deposition that he gave to Bert Griffin. The other point that Griffin latched on to was the fact that, like I said, Dean testified to Ruby admitting up on the fifth floor that he entered the basement from the main street down the main street ramp. Now, myself and again others, and I think it's a fairly widely accepted conclusion now that Ruby did not enter the basement down the main street ramp. There were witnesses there that did not see him. But Dean essentially put these words in Ruby's mouth. And at a time when Secret Service lead Forrest Sorrells was present, and three Dallas police detectives, Clardy, McMillan, and Archer, all these people were present with Dean and Ruby up on the fifth floor jail. And Dean still it started with Dean at that moment, that is when Ruby first admitted to coming into the basement from the fifth floor, but from Main Street, the Main Street down the ramp there. But the thing was, Forrest Sorrells never corroborated that. He said that Ruby did not say that at that time, while he was there at least. And the three Dallas police detectives in their initial statements did not make any reference to A, Ruby, you know, saying that he wanted to kill Oswald since Friday, and B, that Ruby admitted to coming down the down into the basement from Main Street down the ramp. So right there, we're starting to see Dean as the person that really was the catalyst for, you know, the charge of premeditation against Jack Ruby for killing Oswald, and yet he was the person that was in charge of security and clearly didn't know that the area that he was in charge of was, or maybe did know, but and let it be unsecure so someone like Ruby could enter. So Dean is a very, very, you know, suspicious character, and Griffin clearly picked up on this and took him aside and had that conversation with him. But what happened was, after the 24th, the next day, Dean launched a complaint with, it came up through, I think it was Charles Batchelor, an assistant chief with the Dallas police. And he reached out to Griffin and said, you know, how did you go with the conversation with Dean yesterday? Did it go well? And Griffin said, yes, it did. There was nothing out of the ordinary. I did have a conversation with him off the record, but it was cordial, it was polite, and we were able to move on. But after that, Dean's complaint went up the chain all the way to District Attorney Henry Wade and the Texas U.S. Attorney Barefoot Sanders, and they involved the Warren Commission and basically accused Griffin of badgering their witness, as it was, you know, with how he treated, how he was perceived to have treated Dean in that off-the-record chat. So that basically resulted in Griffin being recalled back to Washington, and that's where he stayed. He wasn't allowed back to Dallas to continue the, you know, the next round of depositions. Only Hubert was, as far as I can gather. So what Griffin did was, he clearly stood on a landmine in Patrick Dean, and it went all the way up to the heads of the Warren Commission. And it was all because he was, the Warren Commission never wanted to dig deep into any perceived police corruption. And I think from a Dallas, you know, a public relations perspective as well, and probably the fact that Lyndon Johnson, as president by this time, was a Texas native, I think it was all swept under the rug, and Griffin was pulled back in very tightly, and the whole, essentially, and what my article really points out is that the leads that Griffin and Hubert were cottoning onto from late March were really discontinued. There was nothing really that eventuated, and they were able to derive indirect links. You be the judge. The link between Lee Oswald and Jack Ruby. As I'd say in my article there, Earlene Roberts was Oswald's landlady at the time of the assassination. It turns out that Earlene Roberts' sister, Bertha Cheek, was a business associate of Jack Ruby, who he would have regular contact with in terms of, you know, seeking money from her for business investments. So there's a link right there that through the FBI, admittedly. The Warren Commission, Burt Griffin and Leon Hubert, made special mention of, through the numerous contacts and relationships that the FBI and the Warren Commission and even the Dallas police conceded to a degree, you know, the numerous relationships that Jack Ruby had with Dallas police at the time, that was noted, and that was clearly made a theme for investigation by Griffin and Hubert, and of course why Ruby killed Oswald. Because there was this premeditation on his part was heavily testified to by Patrick Dean at Jack Ruby's trial, and it was used as a fair bit by the defense to gain the basically find Ruby guilty of killing Oswald with premeditation, which of course carried the sentence of death in Dallas at the time. So, the Griffin and Hubert broke onto some things. And, the Warren Commission, as I say in my article, it gets its fair criticism, and it did from almost straight away at the time. People like Mark Lane and right the way through till now, there is strong evidence that the Warren Commission was a whitewash. And I guess the instances of Griffin and Hubert really proved that their ultimate stance in putting everything on the shoulders of Oswald in terms of the killings of Tippit and Kennedy was a directive from the top. And in terms of Ruby, putting laying the suspicion on him and only on him for killing Oswald. So, but despite that, we have evidence that two people, at least in the Warren Commission, tried on this front to push for this having a little bit more exposure in the final Warren report. To the point that they in this memo they recommended that the Warren report have its own chapter on the killing of Lee Harvey Oswald, but of course that never happened. It only got a it was only given a portion within another chapter. So, yeah, just an interesting story to tell, and I know I've gone into a lot of detail there, but I think Patrick Dean with the Dallas Police Department was the catalyst for basically railroading these two attorneys for the Warren Commission away from looking any further into links between Ruby and Dallas police officers. And I mentioned in the article as well as that they came across questions in terms of Ruby's links to firstly Castro revolutionary activities, but then in later years anti-Castro activities. So really, Ruby was one hell of a hot potato himself. He was too hot to handle in terms of what the Warren Commission wanted to get out of its final report.
Okay, I was going to ask you about Dean. That what occurred to me was if detectives or lawyers, whatever, were looking into something, and as they interview you, as they went through everything, you would get the opinion, well, they're doing a good job. They're leaving no stone unturned. They're really trying to find any alternative, anything. Do you have anything more to say? But in this case, here's somebody who is questioned, and he complains about it, and he complains, and it goes all the way up. So that almost is a small footprint of, well, they've got something to hide and they're upset that the people are going into looking for details. Is that an opinion you share?
Yeah, absolutely. And it didn't stop there. Dean did give another statement to the Warren Commission, but it was done in DC, and it was during that. It was actually before people like Alan Dulles and Earl Warren himself. So right before obviously the hierarchy of the Warren Commission, and he virtually got an apology from Earl Warren himself, saying that, none of our attorneys, none of our staff have the power, nor should they, to question a witness's integrity and call them a liar. So, not only is Dean, found to be incredibly suspicious with his testimony, and that's the other thing as well. He was getting questioned in the press by the time his first deposition, and around that time thereafter, his first deposition to the Warren Commission in late March. So by the time he was called to DC and allowed to appear before Dulles and Warren themselves and get an apology, he's still No, he's still not been able to, defend himself in terms of, the suspicion that's on him. And I think even to the point where he himself, I'm not sure when this took place in the scheme of things, but it was in the middle of, I think it might have been June or July, that he asked, personally asked to have a lie detector, sit a lie detector test. So that was granted. He was allowed to write his own questions for the lie detector test, and he still failed it. The Warren Commission weren't told that that this had taken place, that that Dean had sat for and failed his own lie detector test. The results went missing. So when the HSCA came back around in the mid to late 1970s, they came back to the DPD and asked for a copy of Dean's lie detector test and results, and was never given to them. It was declared lost. So and he was Dean himself. He was still alive when the HSCA issued him with an affidavit to appear before them. He refused to do that. He did speak with a member of the HSCA, but it was only to recount, largely to recount his treatment in 1964, including the fact that he failed a lie detector test. So he was a protected species, right the way through. So I think that's what this article highlights, is how the Warren Commission from the highest levels reacted to this, this very, 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 very interesting suspect, and personally intervened to make sure that he was protected. But how the DPD also withheld further incriminating evidence in his lie detector test to the Warren Commission. So it was just a perfect storm that this chap in Pat Dean was able to really skate through. So I think that makes him incredibly suspicious when it comes to not only the setting up of the scene for Oswald's shooting, but also the immediate cover up in terms of laying the blame of premeditation on Jack Ruby straight away. Because he was also down in the talking to the press very early on in that afternoon of the 24th of November, saying that he saw Ruby enter down the Main Street ramp when that couldn't have been possible from where he was standing, at the top of the other ramp where the armored truck was. With how low those ceilings were, it was impossible for anyone to be able to see, high up the other side because of how high the ramps ran and how low the ceiling was in between. A very, very suspicious character that the Warren Commission protected, and so did the DPD.
But that gives you a little insight into the Warren Commission themselves, how they were not going to let anyone do any kind of independent investigation. Their job was to cover up anything and just go along with whatever the FBI gave them. And I mean, everybody covered each other's asses, you know?
There really was an all points agenda to make it all lone nut scenario as possible, and I contend that that treatment was not just on Oswald, but in Jack Ruby. These two lawyers declared that, we want to look into the anti-Castro linkages that Ruby had. We want to look further into the linkages that he clearly had with the Dallas Police Department. These are all the things that they wanted to look into, but we're obviously hamstrung from being able to do that because one of them was banned from going back to Dallas to carry out further depositions. So absolutely, I think we when we criticise the Warren Commission, and rightly so as a collective. I think that we kind of need to almost add a comma and say, but there were people on the ground, on the front line, that did try to raise the serious concerns that they had about certain elements that they considered suspicious. So not just the Boggs and the McCoys and the Richard Russells, the people that were on the panel, or well, most of them were, I think, in some shape or form, would come out and say they didn't agree with the final findings. But there were people in the wheelhouse, so to speak, that tried to do the right thing, So that really needs to be considered when we talk about the criticism of the Warren Commission.
If Dean was more cooperative, what do you think that he might have offered? What do you think that they could have turned up? Do you have any insight into that?
He ought to have been asked a couple of key questions and held to account in terms of, firstly, he was the one that assigned the two reserve officers to that point in the basement where the stairway that Ruby clearly entered from, down from the annex building. There were two reserve officers there up until almost 20 minutes before Oswald ultimately emerged, and Ruby was able to get into position and shoot him. So I think we'd need that confirmation once and for all. It would have been good to get that confirmation once and for all that Dean posted these reserve officers, and indeed why he posted, but basically, volunteers, reserve officers, were basically and still are volunteer personnel, members of the community. These weren't badged police officers, that had a certain level of accountability, per the parameters of their job. These two reserve officers were put there, but Dean also ought to have been scrutinized as to why he indirectly removed these two reserve personnel away from that area. Up to I think Worley was the first officer to be reserve officer to be moved away from that part of the basement, and then Brock was. And as I lay out in my book, it was at the indirect orders of Patrick Dean. So I think he ought to have been would have been good if he was scrutinized on that decision making, because where those officers were deployed to, they weren't needed. It wasn't critical. There was some convoluted story that there was some problem with traffic light signals at one of the intersections that the convoy was meant to go through, but none of the other police personnel that were at or near that intersection testified to that. So, Dean brought some BS to the table in both sworn testimony at Ruby's trial, and to a degree at the with the Warren Commission as well, and to the with his investigation statements to the DPD as well. So he ought to have been held account to that at least, and scrutinized a little bit more about what why how was that area of the basement allowed to be left unsecure, if he was the one that to remove the personnel that were guarding from there. So basically put to him, the evidence suggests that you made it possible for someone to enter the basement from the annex building. Why? That ought to have been the starting point, and then of course with the way he put words up in the words in Ruby's mouth up on the fifth floor immediately after the shooting, he ought to have been held account more to that degree as well, because like I said before, everyone that was present when Dean had Ruby saying all these things about premeditation and how he came down the Main Street ramp and all these things, it wasn't corroborated. Dean was the only person that was saying that Ruby said all these things, and ultimately the three police personnel would follow suit in their own statements. They would come back around and say, "Oh yes, Jack Ruby did say that he came in off Main Street ramp," and they would ultimately, or two of them at least, I think it was McMillan and Clardy would testify also at Ruby's trial, and they got in behind what Patrick Dean had been testifying from literally as being having taken place literally from 12 o'clock Sunday, November the 24th. So really, there was just so much proper questioning that Dean could have been given, but of course the off the record chat that Griffin had with him was turned into a molehill, and it was turned from a molehill into a mountain, and that was used to basically remove Griffin from the scene in terms of being able to take any more depositions in Dallas. So yeah, he was one hell of a hot potato.
But I didn't really get the impression that he was the mastermind of anything. So if he's following orders, the Dallas police then know, listen, they're sending in somebody's going to bump off Oswald. Just, you're here, you're here. Make sure this goes off. And don't worry, we'll take care of you.
I think if we just considered the fact that Dean left that area where the where Ruby would ultimately enter the basement from unchecked, because he removed personnel from there, I think we could say that Dean at best could have been a useful idiot that was just literally following orders of someone like the mastermind, who the person who was behind the shooting of Oswald. But I think with Dean's conduct virtually straight away, in terms of putting words into Ruby's mouth, that he was the figurehead for I guess the beginning of the cover up, and the framing of Ruby as a pre as killing Oswald as an act of premeditation. Whereas I think Ruby, it would have been put to him very simply, Jack, if you do this, it'll be tried as a crime of passion, and you'll only serve a couple of years, and you'll walk out of jail as a hero. I think that's how Ruby would have been enlisted to carry out the shooting. And yes, I think without how Dean conducted himself up on the fifth floor, with railroading Ruby straight away, I think we could have called him just a useful idiot that left a door unlocked, basically, to allow maybe someone that he didn't know was coming in to carry out the shooting of Oswald. I think that's where we could leave Dean in that frame. But he certainly wasn't the mastermind, but he was in charge of setting the scene. And like I say, railroading Ruby up on the fifth floor virtually straight away. It is interesting to note that he did go by take a detour from the basement, which he was still in charge of the security for. He took a detour up to the third floor of City Hall, where obviously Fritz's office was, and there it was where he got the instructions by Curry to take Forrest Sorrells up to the fifth floor and begin, questioning Jack Ruby. So might Dean have gotten some kind of instruction at that point, at that juncture, when he was on the third floor, before he actually took Forrest Sorrells and had contact himself with Jack Ruby? Who knows? So and then from then on, he was acting on orders that he might have received on the third floor. I'm just playing devil's advocate there in terms of how to the degree of Dean's involvement in the conspiracy, but he was certainly involved. There's no doubt about that. And he got away with it. He got away with it, and what he could have told about the instructions that he got from who, you're right, Len, that could have been asked of him a little bit more pointedly, but of course that never happened.
Right, and it's just another fingerprint, footprint in the whole crime that doesn't add up to the story of just Lee Oswald planned the whole thing, and man, it's just you almost think that everybody was in on it. They all decided that they were only too happy to, how can I help?
Yeah, I think as well that's where people get tripped up in terms of the whole grand conspiracy argument. Well, if it was this big grand conspiracy to firstly kill President Kennedy, and the fall, the immediate fallout from that was obviously J.D. Tippit's murder, and subsequently Oswald's after that. How someone would have talked. How can people known of such a big plan, and kept quiet all these years? Well, there's compartmentalization, and I just laid out before how Dean himself could have been a compartmentalized piece In his involvement in the Oswald shooting, because he clearly was. The evidence indicates that. His testimony and the conflicting testimony of others compared to his, that is the evidence against him. But the compartmentalization in terms of the whole grand scheme of things in the conspiracy, all Dean could have been told was leave that door open, for 11 o'clock, and okay, now that Oswald's been shot, you need to get up. You know Jack Ruby, which is true. Patrick Dean did know Jack Ruby. You need to you need to get up to see Ruby, and you need to watch what he's being said. And even after the fact, he could have put those words in Ruby's mouth, testifying to what Ruby said when Ruby never actually said any such thing, because we have evidence that Forrest Sorrells did take note of when Ruby said how he entered the basement. It was on his notes that he scribbled as of 3:15 on that afternoon. Came in off Main Street ramp. They were in Sorrell's notes, and that's because he was in the interrogation that Ruby was having with Captain Fritz, and that was after Ruby had spent time with his lawyer Tom Howard, who's another incredibly suspicious character that Griffin and Howard identified in this memo. Tom Howard was Ruby's attorney for a very short period of time from straight after the shooting. Turns out that Howard was actually present at the time of Oswald's shooting. And we have a couple of Dallas detectives that testified to Howard saying to them, having looked through the jail office window, which is where Oswald was brought out from before being shot, that he'd seen all he needed to see. And he turned around as if to leave the scene. But of course, that's when the shooting happened. So, Griffin and Hubert identified Howard as an incredibly suspicious character, and that was before that would have been after it got out that Howard was one of five people at a meeting at Jack Ruby's apartment on the night of the 24th of November. I don't know if you know about that, Len, but of the five people that were present, you had George Senator, that was Ruby's roommate. You had Tom Howard, who was Ruby's attorney. Jim Martin, who was an associate. He was an attorney himself, I believe. He was an associate of Jack Ruby, and we had two reporters there, Jim Curther and Bill Hunter. Howard, Curther, and Hunter were among the first of the suspicious deaths that started to happen, as of, well, basically Lee Harvey Oswald and Tippit being the first after the Kennedy shooting. So Howard was in the thick of it himself, and Griffin and Hubert identified that in this memo, but nothing was done to probe Howard in terms of, what was he really doing outside the jail office at the time his would-be client was shooting Lee Harvey Oswald, and what of this meeting that happened at Jack Ruby's apartment on the night of the shooting? It was never looked into, and that's just another room in this massive mansion of topics that go with the JFK assassination.
Do you want to speculate at all what they were talking about?
Jim Martin is an interesting character because he was the ultimately he was who would step forth to the Secret Service and volunteer his Six Flags hotel in Fort Worth for Marina Oswald and his her two daughters and Lee Oswald's mother Marguerite to stay, for the next 3 weeks in Secret Service custody. So Jim Martin, right there, linked to Ruby, goes and volunteers an establishment that he owned to house the family of the people that his friend Ruby killed. So that's a suspicious link right there to become Marina Oswald's business manager and have an affair with Marina Oswald as well. So that's a whole other tangent. But just getting back to what the significance of that meeting at Ruby's apartment on the 24th, when George Senator heard that Oswald had been shot at City Hall basement, it hadn't yet been announced that Ruby was the person that did it. But he got on the phone straight away to Jim Martin and said, Ruby's going to need an attorney. That was Jack Ruby killed Oswald. He's going to need an attorney. So that was in the literally the minutes around Oswald being shot by Ruby. So we've got these little linkages between these five people, and I gather that. So just to go back over who was at the apartment, George Senator, Ruby's roommate, Tom Howard, Jim Martin, two attorneys that were associated with Ruby, and two reporters. I gather both of them were out of town reporters that I think Jim Martin arranged to be at Ruby's apartment for this meeting. And God, I mean, I'd be a fly on the wall at that meeting. I mean, what could that have? What might that have? Covered, Ruby's in trouble for shooting Oswald. What do we know? Did we know he was going to do it? Well, I think Senator's phone call to Martin kind of indicates full knowledge on his part. So, I think they were talking about how to fall in with the investigation into Ruby, and whether it would just be a simple case of him being convicted for a crime of passion or if it was premeditation. I don't know, but the fact that there were two reporters there that themselves were suspiciously killed within 17 months of this meeting, it's fascinating to know what took place. George Senator testified for the Warren Commission, and he never let on about that meeting. He never went into any detail if he actually acknowledged it all. I can't recall, but to be a fly on the wall at that meeting, that's for sure, because three of the five people that were there, say Howard, Kerther, and Hunter, would all die suddenly in Howard's part in particular, because he came down, he had a cold or cold-like symptoms, and all of a sudden died of a heart attack, as I remember. And Kerther, he was the he died from a gunshot. And Hunter died from a gunshot in a Los Angeles police department, police station. And Kerther, he received a karate chop or a sharp blow to the back of the neck. So the significance of that meeting, indeed, it could have been dived into if the Warren Commission cared to kind of follow the recommendations of Griffin and Hubert as well.
Yeah, the when you look into those, it's suspicious, very suspicious, and no matter what was said, what are the odds, right?
Yeah, the odds, they're incalculable. I know the executive action, the title card for that movie, the executive action, added in the billions. I know that's a bit of an argument for, the lone nutter's perspective. How can you say that these deaths are associated with President Kennedy's assassination when the odds of them, as being such, are in the billions? Well, that's not the point. If you take them on case by case and look at the significance of those people, and their untimely demise, it does warrant suspicion, rightly so.
Yeah, well, thanks for going into this in this detail, and we urge everyone to read your article, where there's even more. But yeah, the fact I think that the guy said, these guys are digging too deep. They're trying to get me to talk. They're pressuring me, and that just indicates to me that he had something to hide, and he was calling out to other people, look, stop, get him to stop. They're digging too far. And like you said, it went all the way up the chain.
And so does that imply, with Dean pulling that card, does that imply knowledge of or covering for other Confederates within the Dallas Police Department, because interestingly enough, the day after he had that gave that first deposition to Griffin, and I had that off the record chat that he took exception to. Griffin advised Dean that him or anyone appearing before the Warren Commission is more than entitled to bring their own attorney. Of course, that was in that instance, it was too late for Dean. But interestingly enough, another very suspicious character in the scheme of Oswald's shooting, he was scheduled to testify, give his deposition for the Warren Commission the very next day. Charles Blackie Harrison, and he did bring an attorney with him. He was one of two Dallas police personnel that brought their own attorneys for when they were giving their depositions, and it happened to be after Dean was told that had his run-in with Griffin the day before. So Blackie Harrison is incredibly suspicious as well, because he'd be probably most familiar to everyone as the man with putting the cigar to his mouth while reaching out to Jack Ruby as Ruby's shooting Oswald in the that famous Bob Jackson photograph. That's Blackie Harrison, and his whereabouts for upwards of 3 hours on the morning of November 24th is incredibly suspicious, because him and another detective, Lewis Miller, went to a nearby coffee shop, a diner, to get a coffee, which was apparently fairly part and parcel. And Harrison spent most of the time at the diner on the payphone there. And Miller, in his Warren Commission deposition, was very tight-lipped about what he played dumb, basically, about what Harrison was on the phone, talking about. But when they came back from that diner to City Hall, Miller returned, to the bureau up on the third floor. Harrison, his whereabouts were unknown. He's the next time he would be seen was just before Oswald was brought out in the basement, where another detective, Cutshaw, would see him walking into the basement and saying, "Where have you been?" And Harrison said, "Oh, I've been down in the locker room, buying some cigars from the vending machine." Well, the fact that he was answered that question from someone in the same bureau or division as him implies that this Harrison wasn't on the third floor for a fair period of time up until that point. So I contend that Harrison was down in the sub-basement locker room holding fort down there near some payphones, and was part of the plan to get Ruby into place, and part of the timing of it all. So he was the own he was one of two Dallas police personnel that lawyered up for their time in front of the Warren Commission. And I'll tell you who the other person was that also lawyered up. It was his friend, the detective that went with him to the coffee shop earlier that morning, Lewis Miller. He also brought an attorney with him when he was testifying to the Warren Commission. So, a bit of a ripple when we look into not only Dean's conduct, at his deposition and what he took exception to with Griffin, but subsequently two other Dallas police personnel that are very, very suspicious in terms of their conduct before Oswald's shooting. And in terms of Miller, I would say just directly after Ruby shot Oswald, because he can be seen in very slowed down footage of the shooting coming in and actually covering Jack Ruby with some kind of garment. Jack Ruby's hatless head can be seen, and then all of a sudden Miller comes in and literally covers him with some kind of black garment, whether it's a jacket or some kind of bag. So if that doesn't make him a suspicious person alone, let alone his movements with Harrison earlier on that morning, I don't know what was. So of course he lawyered up for the Warren Commission as well. So it's a very interesting side piece in the scheme of things.
Yeah, and as we were saying, who would complain in an investigation You know, like for instance, let's say somebody a shot at Barack Obama, regarded fine as a president. And we'll get into all that, but you know, people would say, "I'll help you to turn every stone. What do you need? And where was I? I'll give you exact word for word everything." But you know, I'm thinking of the Trump assassination attempt, where they blamed it on this kid. He got up in there with a ladder with a gun. Nobody saw nothing. He's up there for half an hour, and as soon as he shoots at Trump, then they shoot him. And then you go to his house and it's completely sanitized and there's no investigation. And then it's like, what the hell? You know, you can tell when there's some kind of cover story brewing and something just not right. Hopefully, with maybe more records being released from Trump, that may be one reason why he's agreed to release documents that he's upset with these agencies like the Secret Service or the FBI or that, and he's saying, you know, you tried that on me. Okay, I'm just gonna let everybody know how crooked you guys are.
Yeah, he felt the impact of being shot at, and obviously could probably empathize just that little bit more if that was possible with obviously President Kennedy and what happened to him. So, yeah, it gave Trump that just that little bit more personal skin in the game, as it was, in terms of releasing assassination records of another president, for sure.
Well, people have had an interest in the history, and look at how the Warren Commission and all the stuff that went on, and people have gone over it, and years and years, and you know, some interested citizens like yourself and things like that are just really been going through saying what really happened. And here, there's like no, almost 1% of an investigation. You know, we don't know anything about that. I mean, I guess, you know, with Trump, he just turned his head and the bullet hit his ear, you know, I mean, just fluke, luck, whatever you want to call it, right? And
absolutely.
Yeah. And here in the, you know, with the murder of Lee Oswald, the whole day seems to be suspicious. They're holding him, they're releasing him, he's not going. You know, Ruby's across the street making a phone call, people are on the phone, you know, Tippett was on the phone, everything. There's a whole plan was in action, and it didn't go off exactly as planned, and so they had to adapt. You know, personally, I think that Lee Oswald should have been, I think, you know, just speculating, that he was supposed to run out the back alley of that theater and he would have been shot there from the cast of characters that were out around the back, but he didn't, and then he went out the front door, and then he go, okay, now what do we do?
I'd probably take it back even further and say that if he really was prayer man, you know, standing on the steps of the book depository, there was no justification for a quick acting police officer to shoot Oswald in the inside of the book depository and plant some kind of weapon as the fleeing assassin of you know, the fleeing shooter of Kennedy, you know, in terms of those seconds immediately after. But because, you know, if he is Bart Camp, I think very well incredibly states, if Oswald was prayer man standing on the steps, there was no justification to shoot him there. So I think the plan was to, you know, they moved to a plan B or plan C, which was to create a reason to kill Oswald, and that was obviously with the subsequent murder of J.D. Tippett, and lead the trail to Oswald. And yes, maybe Oswald was meant to flee from there as well, but again, he played it very smart, and as soon as he was being descended upon, he started shouting, I'm not resisting arrest, I'm not resisting arrest. So again, with bystanders around, there was no justification to shoot him there and then. So, you know, plan D or plan F was swung into action, which was obviously you know, getting some you know, mob connected police groupie, you know, who love pleasing people and being in the thick of the action to step in and you know, do it once and for all on that Sunday.
Right. Well, it's very interesting, this memo that you've gone through and helped publicize for people who are interested in just what happened. So your article's up at Kennedy's and King, and we'll certainly make a link to that. I guess we've gone over it, you know, before we wrap up, though. Is there anything else you want to get to, didn't bring up, or?
Yeah, well, I'd just say this memo, I do have the original version of in my book, Death to Justice, the Shooting of Lee Harvey Oswald. And that book in itself, really, I guess with what I'm doing with this memo now is I'm just bringing people's attention to evidence that really always it's always been there. So I've not uncovered anything that hasn't already been there to be uncovered as it was, you know. So my book, it's really all about establishing, you know, City Hall and the basement as being its own Dealey Plaza, you know, its own Ambassador Hotel kitchen, you know, a crime scene where there were so many stories and so many nuances and so many suspicious things take place that you know, it turns out there was a lot of witnesses who, you know, gave some good testimony and you know, others gave conflicting testimony. There is a lot, and I think I just want to tell people out there that, you know, with if we do get you know, these documents released as Trump's promising, you know, go through it by all means. But there has been a hell of a lot out there already. And how I came to do this start on this journey in terms of putting the spotlight on Oswald's shooting was through the index for the Garrison folders. You know, that's something that you generously provide people, Len, and I gather you send out the index with it as well, which is fantastic. But you know, we've always had a lot out there, and I think it is we can still, as researchers, still sensibly look through records and documents and piece puzzles, you know, piece you know, pieces of the puzzle together. And who knows what will be possible once or if these new documents are released. You know, a tool like your Garrison folders and the index, what that might do as well. So, you know, we can still do good work with what's always been available. Who knows what's possible with what's to come with Trump releasing the next round of files.
Yeah, who knows? But like you say, for people to go through it, there is a lot already there. And what it does is it just contradicts the Warren Commission and the lone assassin. The further you look into it, it doesn't help. You know, when we've listened to Elon Musk talking about what they found in this USAID money, they sponsored this, they sponsored that, all these non-governmental agencies that are funding all these other publications and news outfits. So the fact that you still get somebody pulling out Gerald Posner on, you know, 60 plus years later to say, oh, by the way, you know, don't put too much faith in what's coming out because we all know Lee Oswald did it. I mean, it's beyond reason.
Well, when they bring out someone like Posner, you know that the other side are getting worried or getting overwhelmed by the, you know, the noise that we're making in terms of sensible researchers and critics of the you know, the BS that's the official narrative. So I always take it as a positive when I see someone like Posner being trotted out, you know,
Well, you're
despite
better than
what
me because I usually rush for a garbage can, and you know, I can't believe it. I think kind of the opposite. I go, wow, their amount of bullshit in propaganda is still working because they're still willing to bring this out. And they still found some news agency that an editor's been told, okay, have him out, call him, call me, you know, don't call Jim DiEugenio or don't call, I don't know, John Newman, anyone, you know what I mean? Don't call these guys. Call the guys we know that are going to stick to the tried and true thing, you know, and that's what, you know, I kind of got the idea that for Dean to be complaining, he would have to know he's got help. And we don't care how far up the
That's
chain.
right.
We'll help you. Don't worry. We'll handle
Yep.
this.
100%. And Wade, just as one very small thing, Wade, in his eventual testimony to the Warren Commission, he backed up Dean 100%. So it's a right there. He was a benefactor of Dean, and therefore, in my eyes, a benefactor of your stakeholder in terms of covering up, you know, the Dallas complicity in Oswald's shooting, and then beyond that, obviously, what happened in Dealey Plaza as well. So, yeah, you're right. The chain, when we look at it, it's very clear to see, and it does involve the media as well. The media swung into action almost immediately in terms of towing the line, and the big networks, the big papers have done so ever since, and we still see that today, as you say, and just got to keep pushing back. That's all.
Yeah, and from, when the Warren Commission volumes, the 26 volumes are released the next day, no one's had time to read them. They just go on and say, "Oh, they've looked into it," and everybody go back to sleep, It kind of reminds
That's
me of
serious.
9/11 when you think, "Well, I wonder what happened. I wonder what happened." And then you see Building 7 fall and you go, "Well, wait a minute. That's a controlled demolition. If that was Building 7 and it didn't get hit by anything, let me look back and look at one and two, and they fall straight down. They fall in, and they're pulverized in midair. They're pulverized. I mean, so that's
100%.
another. I know it's another topic, but I mean, it's kind of a tried and true thing. Just keep parroting the lie you want them to believe, and shut down any opposition, and
That's right.
especially
They
with,
do that they do that with money and influence. Absolutely.
yeah, right. Okay, Paul, thank you so much for writing this, and we'll make links to your book as well. But
Thanks.
yeah, so we've been speaking to Paul Abbott, and
Yeah, I've got a website, deathtojustice.com. So, that's got links to my YouTube, Twitter, and Substack, as well as information about my book. So, deathtojustice.com, that's where you can find out all about this work, and links to the other things I've done as well.
sure. Okay, very good. I should have asked for that to start with, but most of the time, people click on the link and they're not looking at the show notes and they just start listening. But now that I'll put that as the number one show note, so if people see that, they'll know there's a website to follow and even more. All right, well, keep in touch with me via email and we'll just take it from there.
Absolutely.
All right.
Always good to talk to you. Keep it up, Len.
Yeah,
Thanks so much.
thank you very much. Okay, good night.
Cheers.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. In this segment, we're speaking to Professor Jim DiEugenio. How you doing, Jim?
Good evening, Len.
Well, it finally happened. There has been a release of JFK files, and under the unlikely president of Trump, who followed through, we'll see what happens. I'm not sure if it was Tulsi Gabbard that okayed it, but files have been released. And I've just called to get your take on it. I know a lot of people are talking, and there's some positive, there's some negative. So what's your first impression?
First of all, I think you're correct. I think Tulsi Gabbard deserves a lot of credit for this because she's the DNI, and I think she overrode a lot of the objections of the intel community. Now, second of all, what's really remarkable about this is how few redactions there are in the documents. So, and many, the vast majority of them, are absolutely clean. They have no redactions at all. I've never seen anything like that before. Usually, every document I've ever seen in its original form has had at least a couple of redactions in it. But most of these, even though, from my understanding, they've been released before, I believe they're in cleaner form. So that's what's good about it. Now, from my understanding also, what they've done is they've mixed in old documents with new documents. So I think it's like sifting through like a whole trough of water trying to find, one a nickel or something, at the bottom. All right. So that's what's going to be difficult about this. Now, some of the things that I found interesting, because I have not seen any bombshell document yet, but who can find one in 67,000 pages in 2 days? First of all, Fidel Castro was so doubtful about the Warren Commission verdict that he staged a reenactment with his best marksmen. And guess what, Len? They couldn't do it. Now, this is the second time I've heard this. The first time was at Carlos Hathcock, who had a SWAT team obstacle course, I think, in Maryland or something, or Virginia. He tried to stage the Kennedy assassination just by the book, and he couldn't do it. He was the greatest marksman of the whole Vietnam War. 93 confirmed kills as a sniper. So now we have a second reenactment that didn't work by Fidel Castro. I thought that was pretty interesting. Now, this I think is even more interesting. Everyone who listens to your show knows the importance of Valery Kostikov. Valery Kostikov was the KGB agent under diplomatic cover at the Russian embassy in Mexico City, who, according to the official story, which I don't believe, all right, is one of the people who talked to Oswald when Oswald was allegedly there. That's the part I don't believe, all right? But that's the official story. That's what's in the Warren Commission. On the day of or the day after the assassination, James Angleton released a story saying that Valery Kostikov was part of Department 13. Now, I know everybody's going to know this, but I'm going to repeat it anyway. According to Angleton, Department 13 was responsible for liquidations in the Western Hemisphere. So, of course, the message was that somehow Kostikov put up Oswald to the assassination for the KGB, which is what James Angleton's story was pushing, all right? I just looked through some of the early documents today. In a CIA document from 1971, they say, we don't know if Kostikov was in Department 13 or not. We have no provable case. When I read that, my eyebrows arched, because the implication of that information is that Angleton went ahead and did this on his own. He put Kostikov in Department 13 to incriminate Oswald. That was the most surprising thing that I read so far. That shows you just how sick James Angleton was. All right, now, let me tell you something about, to give you a little bit of background on the next thing I'm going to tell you. When me and Oliver Stone were working on JFK Revisited, since Oliver had done the Putin interviews over in Russia, he decided to write a letter to some of the people who handled, you know, the whole thing for him, because he was asking for any information that they could get out of the archive about their surveillance of Oswald in Minsk. Well, we got back a nothing burger kind of response. Okay, like, you know, sorry, but we can't help you. The CIA had a double agent inside the KGB. I think his name was Nokonov or something like that. He said that, A, the Russians had a 5-volume set on Oswald. The KGB accumulated 5 volumes on their surveillance of Oswald. And disagreeing with John Newman, he said, no, he was never recruited by the KGB. Now, here's my question. What happened to those 5 volumes? I would love to see what the heck the KGB was doing with Oswald, you know, the kind of surveillance that they had on him. You know, they must have had, you know, literally wall to wall. All right, now, one last highlight, okay? The entire 16-page memo about Arthur Schlesinger's reorganization of the CIA is now declassified. I'm pretty sure that the whole thing is out there. You know, he did this at Kennedy's request, and there's some very harsh language in there about Schlesinger's thoughts about the CIA, how he thinks they've gotten completely out of line, you know, and they've become an embarrassment in many ways to the intelligence community, et cetera. All right. Now, let me also say this. Birch O'Neill was one of James Angleton's most trusted assistants, except unlike Ray Rocha, who was the number one assistant, he kept a very, 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 very low profile. In fact, the only person that I know was John Newman who ever talked to him, okay? Now, Birch O'Neill, as early as June of 1964, he was looking for sources that would incriminate the CIA in the Kennedy assassination. He was collecting these things. Now, Len, here's the problem with that. The Warren Commission report isn't even out yet. So this is under, you know, that is pretty incriminating, I think, that he's looking for this stuff in the summer of 1964. Also, it looks like there's a handwritten document that Priscilla Johnson was recruited by the CIA. I think this was in 1959. Okay, I had never seen this before. So that's part of Mockingbird that's being exposed. And also there's an 8 or 9 page memo about two reporters for the Miami News who, under code names, but we can figure out who they are, okay, that they had done a lot of work for the CIA, all right? So they're sacrificing, it looks like they're sacrificing part of Mockingbird, you know, which is pretty interesting because that's always been, you know, one of their most prized possessions. They never wanted to give up Mockingbird, okay? They always wanted to keep it a secret, but they have in these two documents, you know. So these are some, you know, look, you have to go through a lot of stuff in order to find these kind of little jewels. But in my opinion, I think it's actually worth it, that there are some very interesting things in this. Maybe there'll be some bombshells later, all right? But it's going to take some work, and it's going to take a while to go ahead and get through all of this stuff, all right? Now,
well, what we can do is we can mention some of the opposition from the major networks, right? You know, because that's just, I couldn't believe that, right? They're still saying, people coming out and saying, oh, Oswald did it, so go back to sleep.
Right, right. And by the way, to give you a little bit more detail, there were two batches dropped yesterday, okay? One was early in the evening, Eastern Standard Time. Then one was late at night. I think one was at 7 p.m. and one was 10:30. And the total comes to about 64,000 pages. I expect there's going to be another batch to make it the 80,000 pages that Trump talked about at the Kennedy Center. Okay, the two reporters that I was talking about were Al Burt and I think his name is Dan Bonning, okay, for the Miami News. They've been completely exposed as CIA officers, or not officers, assets, okay? So, and I'm, by the way, I've never seen anything like that document before, where the CIA just gives up, they did this, they did this, they did this for us. They can, you know, I've never seen anything like that before in my whole life, all right? So that's a very interesting document, all right? Now, as far as the mainstream coverage, I couldn't believe this. Rachel Maddow, you know, the big MSNBC honcho, all right, she had Philip Shannon on. Do you believe that? Philip Shannon wrote that horrendous book, A Cruel and Shocking Act, which was another Warren Commission cover-up where he supports a single bullet theory. Now, what do you think this guy's going to say? Well, she knew what he was going to say. Okay, that there's next to nothing in these documents. Okay, Phil, how many did you read? Okay, how come I could find this stuff out but you couldn't? So that's who she had on. Now, there was another guy on MSNBC who I guess didn't like that, and he had Jeff Morley on. Okay, but the best, if you want to see some really daring stuff, take a look at what Jesse Waters did today on Fox. Okay, now look, I don't watch Fox, all right? You know, there's too much spin. But a friend of mine, Chuck Marler, told me, Jim, you got to see the last segment of Jesse Waters' show today. So I went to YouTube and I looked at it. Len, I'm not exaggerating. I could not have written a better intro myself. Go ahead, and if you think I'm exaggerating, take a look, Okay. This guy, he talks about this whole thing about, he actually shows part of Eisenhower's military-industrial complex speech. Okay. He talks about how Kennedy was duped by Alan Dulles with the Bay of Pigs, how he fired Dulles, how he was anti-colonial in the Third World, how he was working for a detente. He even showed the American University speech, right? And then he said the Warren Commission didn't know which way the bullets came in or out. Okay, you know, I see something like that, and, you know, maybe we're making some progress. You know, maybe we're a little bit changing the narrative. You know, and Fox has a lot more viewers than Rachel Maddow. All right? So that really gave me, you know, I'm really kind of, I recommend everybody watch it. So that was really, really encouraging. All right, now, we'll have, you know, people are still looking through these things. And did you know this? The New York Times has six people. Barbara, you know, one of your loyal listeners, told me about this. They have something like six people, it might be even more, going through these documents. But you know what they did on the first day? Adam Nagorny, one of the guys going through the documents, wrote an editorial saying, the headline I think was, Oswald still did it. Now here's my question. If you haven't read 64,000 pages, how do you know that's still true? It wasn't true in the first place. See, the New York Times doesn't realize how bad they screwed up with the Warren Report in the first place, which Gary Aguilar did a very nice job exposing in JFK Revisited. Okay, how they, you know, they were going ahead and endorsing the thing without even reading it. Okay, and so they're stuck with this now. They don't want to admit that there's pile over their faces. You know, so they have to go ahead and they have to keep up, you know, this concealment of what the truth is in the JFK case. All right, now, when you get shown up by Fox, all right, then I think that's pretty much says the whole story. You know, that's really pretty bad. All right, now, Jeff Morley says that the entire James Angleton testimony before the Church Committee is now fully declassified. All right. There were, I think, 30-some or 40-some pages, you know, that say that were blacked out before. All right. So this is pretty interesting. I didn't get to see that. All right. But I will take a look at that. And maybe the next time I'm on, we can talk about that a little. All right, because several of the documents that were declassified yesterday and today had to deal with James Angleton. All right, so maybe we'll find more about this. All right, so that's something that we can really look forward to. By the way, everybody's talking about this document about Gary Underhill that the CIA declassified. I had Gary Underhill in my first book, the first edition of Destiny Betrayed. So I talked about today in Sydney. I did a show today, Sky News for Fox down in Sydney. And I said, yes, Gary Underhill is a very, very interesting character. You know who he is, right?
Yeah, but for those who don't, just give a brief.
Okay, all right. Either the day after or the day of the Kennedy assassination, Gary Underhill went, you know something, Len? I think the best thing I can do, let me go get my book. Okay. This is from the first edition of Destiny Betrayed. As early as the night of the assassination, there was a hint that the machinations in and around New Orleans were connected to Washington. On that evening of November the 22nd, Gary Underhill was a deeply troubled man. What he learned and the fact that they knew he had learned it were too much for him. He had to escape. Once he was out of Washington, he could regain his equilibrium. Then he would decide what to do. He had friends in New York that he could talk to without fear of the word getting back to Washington. He arrived on Long Island the next morning. His friend Robert Fitzsimmons was asleep. Him and his wife Charlene were about to leave on a long trip to Spain that day. When Underhill learned of the trip, he said, "You're going to Spain? That's the best thing to do. I've got to get out of the country. This country's too dangerous for me now." He paused and then he said, "I've got to get on a boat too. I'm really afraid for my life." Charlene realized something was wrong with the usually rational and objective Underhill, but Underhill insisted he had not been drinking. "It was the Kennedy assassination. It's not what it seemed to be. Oswald is a patsy." Now get this. This is like 24 hours after the assassination. Gary Underhill is saying Oswald is a patsy. "They set him up. It's too much. The bastards have gone something outrageous. They've killed the president. I've been listening and hearing things. I couldn't believe they'd get away with it, but they did." Who was they?" she said. "We. I mean the United States. We don't do that sort of thing. They've gone mad. They're a bunch of drug runners and gun runners, a real violent group. The CIA is under enough pressure already without that bunch in Southeast Asia. Kennedy gave them time after the Bay of Pigs. He said he'd give them a chance to save face. They're so stupid, they can't even get the right man. They tried it in Cuba, and they couldn't get away with it, right after the Bay of Pigs. But Kennedy wouldn't let them do it. And now he'd gotten wind of this, and he was really going to blow the whistle on them. And they killed him. But I know who they are. That's the problem. They know I know. That's why I'm here. I can't stay in New York. Can you put me up?" She replied, "They were going to Europe in a few hours and would be gone for months. Well, maybe I can go with you." Now she was frightened. Recovering, she said, he could only stay for a few hours. When her husband woke up, he could have the key for a few days. Underhill mulled it over. "No, that's all right. Maybe I shouldn't leave the country." He turned towards the door. "I'll come back in a couple of hours. Bob will be up by then." He walked out without saying goodbye or saying where he was going. All right. Now, Gary Underhill had a background in the OSS, and he was a small arms expert, limited warfare. He didn't work for the CIA, but he consulted with the CIA, and he was very close to Life magazine and Fortune magazine and Henry Luce. All right, and he was familiar with the top guys in the Pentagon and the CIA. All right, Asher Burns was a writer for the New Republic who Gary confided in. And he also knew, Asher Burns also knew his estranged wife, Patricia. Underhill didn't leave the country. He returned to Washington, and he began to quietly investigate the assassination. He spoke about it to Burns. On May the 8th, 1964, Burns visited Underhill's apartment. When nobody answered, he walked in, and he discovered Underhill in bed. He thought he was sleeping, but his face seemed to be discolored. It had a yellow-green hue. He then walked closer, and he saw a bullet hole in his friend's head. He'd been dead for days. No one in the apartment heard a gun go off. Underhill had been shot behind the left ear. The gun was under his left side, but Underhill was right-handed. Despite these strange circumstances, the coroner ruled it a suicide. Burns was disgusted with the conclusion, but he did not pursue the matter. All right, Patricia Underhill would not talk to anybody about her husband's death and refused to turn over any papers he may have written concerning the assassination. So now everybody can catch up to what I wrote about years ago about Gary Underhill. That's one of the most powerful, one of the most strange, one of the most mysterious stories in the whole Kennedy assassination. How this guy knew what he did know, within like 24 hours of the assassination is simply amazing. It's startling, you know. I think Jesse Waters showed that document, by the way, all right, about Underhill. But I had more than one source. I had about three sources on the Underhill story. So that those three pages I have on Underhill, which, by the way, is also in the second edition of Destiny Betrayed, you know, that's the longest treatment you're going to see any place about Gary Underhill, all right? And nobody's ever investigated this, as far as I know. Such a strange and compelling story. So anyway, Len, that's the first huge, and I, like I said, I expect there to be a second document dump, okay, very soon, all right? And
all right.
Again,
yeah,
again,
good.
I think we should single out Tulsi Gabbard for this. I got a funny feeling that she's the one that overrode everybody. I always liked her. Did you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I always thought she was pretty cool.
You know, I saw that picture of her with Jim Douglas's book, and I thought, well,
right,
she's gonna
I'm
read.
Glad you brought that up. Okay. Because she read JFK and the Unspeakable. And I wonder if that pushed her into doing this, you know?
Or at least just be level-headed enough to know you know, not trotting out Gerald Posner and all that kind of stuff, right?
So, right.
You know, she goes,
right.
Okay, there's more to this story. What have some of the solid researchers, you know, said? And, yeah, good. All right, then, well, we'll keep in touch. I just wanted to have a quick, short, just talk with you just to let people know that we were looking into it. And there's, you know, it's just so early. Let's give it 2 weeks, right?
Well, longer than that. It's going to take a while to read all this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. All right, Len. Have a good night, partner.
All right. Thank you very much, Jim.
Bye-bye.
Good night.